pushed open a door in the barn-like structure that was the outer armory. Here, I knew, the practice weapons were kept. The good iron and steel were up in the keep itself. Within the armory was a gentle half-light, and a slight coolness, along with a smell of wood and sweat and fresh-strewn reeds. She did not hesitate, and I followed her to a rack that supported a supply of peeled poles. "Choose one," she told me, the first words she'd spoken since directing me to follow her. "Hadn't I better wait for Hod?" I asked timidly. "I am Hod," she replied impatiently. "Now pick yourself a stave, boy. I want a bit of time alone with you before the others come, to see what you're made of and what you know." It did not take her long to establish that I knew next to nothing and was easily daunted. After but a few knocks and parries with her own brown rod, she easily caught mine a clip that sent it spinning from my stung hands. "Hm," she said, not harshly nor kindly. The same sort of noise a gardener might make over a seed potato that had a bit of blight on it. I quested out toward her and found the same sort of quietness I'd encountered in the mare. She had none of Burridge's guardedness toward me. I think it was the first time I realized that some people, like some animals, were totally unaware of my reaching out toward them. I might have quested farther into her mind, except that I was so relieved at not finding any hostility that I feared to stir any. So I stood small and still before her inspection. "Boy, what are you called?" she demanded suddenly. "Again. Fitz." She frowned at my soft words. I drew myself up straighter and spoke louder. "Fitz is what Burridge calls me." She flinched slightly. "He would. Calls a bitch and a bastard, does Burridge. Well, I suppose I see his reasons. Fitz you are, and Fitz you'll be called by me as well. Now, I shall show you why the pole you selected was too long for you, and too thick, and then you shall select another." And she did. And I did. And she took me slowly through an exercise that seemed infinitely complex then, but by the end of the week was no more difficult than braiding my horse's mane. We finished just as the rest of her students came trooping in. There were four of them, all within a year or two of my age, but all more experienced than I. It made for an awkwardness, as there were now an odd number of students, and no one particularly wanted the new one as a sparring partner. Somehow I survived the day, though the memory of how fades into a blessedly vague haze. I remember how sore I was when she finally dismissed us, how the others raced up the path and back to the keep, while I trailed dismally behind them, beating myself for ever coming to the king's attention. It was a long climb to the keep, and the hall was crowded and noisy. I was too weary to eat much. Stew and bread, I think, were all I had, and I had left the table and was limping toward the door, thinking only of the warmth and quiet of the stables, when Brant again accosted me. "Your chamber is ready," was all he said. I shot a desperate look at Burridge, but he was engaged in conversation with the man next to him. He didn't notice my plea at all. So, once more, I found myself following Brant. This time, up a wide flight of stone steps, into a part of the keep I had never explored. We paused on a landing, and he took up a candelabra from a table there and kindled its tapers. "Royal family lives down this wing," he casually informed me. "The king has a bedroom big as the stable at the end of this hallway." I nodded, blindly believing all he told me, though I later found that an errand boy such as Brant would never have penetrated the royal wing. That would be for more important lackeys. Up another flight he took me and again paused. "Visitors get rooms here," he said, gesturing with the light, so that the wind of his motion set the flames to streaming. "Important ones, that is. and up another flight we went, the steps perceptibly narrowing from the first two. At the next landing we paused again, and I looked with dread up an even narrower and steeper flight of steps. But Brandt did not take me that way. Instead we went down this new wing, three doors down, and then he slid a latch on a plank door and shouldered it open. It swung heavily and not smoothly. "Room hasn't been used in a while," he observed cheerily. "But now it's yours and you're welcome to it." And with that, he set the candelabra down on a chest, plucked one candle from it, and left. He pulled the heavy door closed behind him as he went, leaving me in the semi-darkness of a large and unfamiliar room. Somehow, I refrained from running after him or opening the door. Instead, I took up the candelabra and lit the wall sconces. Two other sets of candles set the shadows writhing back into the corners. There was a fireplace with a pitiful effort at a fire in it. I poked it up a bit, more for light than for heat, and set to exploring my new quarters. It was a simple square room with a single window. Stone walls, of the same stone as that under my feet, were softened only by a tapestry hung on one wall. I held my candle high to study it, but could not illuminate much. I could make out a gleaming and winged creature of some sort, and a kingly personage in supplication before it. I was later informed it was King Wisdom being befriended by the Elderling. At the time, it seemed menacing to me. I turned aside from it. Someone had made a perfunctory effort at freshening the room. There was a scattering of clean reeds and herbs on the floor, and the feather bed had a fat, freshly shaken look to it. The two blankets on it were good wool. The bed curtains had been pulled back, and the chest and bench that were the other furnishings had been dusted. To my inexperienced eyes, it was a rich room indeed. A real bed, with coverings and hangings about it, and a bench with a cushion to it, and a chest to put things in were more furniture than I could recall having to myself before. That they were for my exclusive use made them larger somehow. There was also the fireplace. That I boldly added another piece of wood to, and the window with an oak seat before it, shuttered now against the night air, but probably looking out over the sea. The chest was a simple one, cornered with brass fittings. The outside of it was dark, but when I opened it, the interior was light-colored and fragrant. Inside the chest, I found my limited wardrobe, brought up from the stables. Two nightshirts had been added to it, and a woolen blanket was rolled up in the corner of the chest. That was all. I took out a nightshirt and closed the chest. I set the nightshirt down on the bed and then clambered up myself. It was early to be thinking of sleep, but my body ached, and there seemed nothing else for me to do. Down in the stable room, by now Burrich would be sitting and drinking and mending harness or whatever. There would be a fire in the hearth, and the muffled sounds of horses as they shifted in their stalls below. The room would smell of leather and oil, and Burrich himself, not dank stone and dust. I pulled the nightshirt over my head and nudged my clothes to the foot of the bed. I nestled into the feather bed. It was cool, and my skin stood up in goosebumps. Slowly, my body heat warmed it, and I began to relax. It had been a full and strenuous day. Every muscle I possessed seemed to be both aching and tired. I knew I should rise once more to put the candles out, but I could not summon the energy, nor the willpower to blow them out and let a deeper darkness flood the chamber. So I drowsed, half-lidded eyes watching the struggling flames of the small hearth fire. I idly wished for something else. for any situation that was neither this forsaken chamber nor the tenseness of Burrich's room, for a restfulness that perhaps I had once known somewhere else, but could no longer recall. And so I drowsed into oblivion.
4. Apprenticeship. A story is told of King Victor, he who conquered the inland territories that became eventually the Duchy of Faro. Very shortly after adding the lands of Sand's Edge to his rulings, he sent for the woman who would, had Victor not conquered her land, have been the Queen of Sand's Edge. She travelled to Buckkeep in much trepidation, fearing to go, but fearing more the consequences to her people if she appealed to them to hide her. When she arrived, she was both amazed and somewhat chagrined that Victor intended to use her not as a servant, but as a tutor to his children, that they might learn both the language and customs of her folk. When she asked him why he chose to have them learn her folk's ways, he replied, "A ruler must be of all his people, for one can only rule what one knows." Later, she became the willing wife of his eldest son, and took the name Queen Graciousness at her coronation. I awoke to sunlight in my face. Someone had entered my chamber and opened the window shutters to the day. A basin, cloth, and jug of water had been left on top of the chest. I was grateful for them, but not even washing my face refreshed me. Sleep had left me sodden, and I recall feeling uneasy that someone could enter my chamber and move freely about without awakening me. As I had guessed, the window looked out over the sea, but I didn't have much time to devote to the view. A glance at the sun told me that I had overslept. I flung on my clothes and hastened down to the stables without pausing for breakfast. But Burrich had little time for me that morning. "Get back up to the keep," he advised me. "Mistress Hasty already sent Brant down here to look for you. She's to measure you for clothing. Best go find her quickly. She lives up to her name and won't appreciate your upsetting her morning routine." My trot back up to the keep reawakened all my aches of the day before. Much as I had dreaded seeking out this Mistress Hasty and being measured for clothing I was certain I didn't need, I was relieved not to be on horseback again this morning. After querying my way up from the kitchens, I finally found Mistress Hasty in a room several doors down from my bedchamber. I paused shyly in the door and peered in. 3 tall windows were flooding the room with sunlight and a mild salt breeze. Baskets of yarn and dyed wool were stacked against one wall, while a tall shelf on another wall held a rainbow of cloth goods. 2 young women were talking over a loom, and in the far corner, a lad not much older than I was rocking to the gentle pace of a spinning wheel. I had no doubt that the woman with her broad back to me was Mistress Hasty. The 2 young women noticed me and paused in their conversation. Mistress Hasty turned to see where they stared, and a moment later, I was in her clutches. She didn't bother with names or explaining what she was about. I found myself up on a stool, being turned and measured and hummed over with no regard for my dignity or indeed my humanity. She disparaged my clothing to the young women, remarked very calmly that I quite reminded her of young chivalry, and that my measurements and colouring were much the same as his had been when he was my age. She then demanded their opinions as she held up bolts of different goods against me.
"That one," said one of the loom women, "that blue quite flat as his darkness. It would have looked well on his father. Quite a mercy that patience never has to see the boy. Chivalry's stamp is much too plain on his face to leave her any pride at all."
And as I stood there, draped in wool goods, I heard for the first time what every other person in Buckkeep knew full well. The weaving women discussed in detail how the word of my existence had reached Buckkeep and Patience long before my father could tell her himself, and of the deep anguish it caused her.
for Patience was barren, and though Chivalry had never spoken a word against her, all guessed how difficult it must be for an heir such as he to have no child to eventually assume his title. Patience took my existence as the ultimate rebuke, and her health, never sound after so many miscarriages, completely broke, along with her spirit. It was for her sake, as well as for propriety, that Chivalry had given up his throne and taken his invalid wife back to the warm and gentle lands that were her home province. Word was that they lived well and comfortably there, that Patience's health was slowly mending, and that Chivalry, substantially quieter a man than he had been before, was gradually learning stewardship of his vineyard-rich valley. A pity that Patience blamed Burridge as well for Chivalry's lapse in morals, and had declared she could no longer abide the sight of the man. For between the injury to his leg and Chivalry's abandonment of him, old Burridge just wasn't the man he had been. It was a time when no woman of the keep walked quickly past him. To catch his eye was to make yourself the envy of nearly anyone old enough to wear skirts. And now, old Burridge, they called him, and him still in his prime. And so unfair, as if any manservant had any say over what his master did. But it was all to the good anyway, they supposed. And didn't Verity, after all, make a much better king-in-waiting than had Chivalry? So rigorously noble was Chivalry that he made all others feel slatternly and stingy in his presence. He'd never allowed himself a moment's respite from what was right, and while he was too chivalrous to sneer at those who did, one always had the feeling that his perfect behavior was a silent reproach to those with less self-discipline. Ah, but then, here was the bastard now, though, after all those years, and, well, here was the proof that he hadn't been the man he'd pretended to be. Verity, now there was a man among men, a king folk could look to and see as royalty. He rode hard and soldiered alongside his men, and if he was occasionally drunk or had at times been less than discreet, well, he owned up to it, honest as his name. Folk could understand a man like that, and follow him. To all this I listened avidly, if mutely, while several fabrics were held against me, debated and selected. I gained a much deeper understanding of why the keep children left me to play alone. If the women considered that I might have thoughts or feelings about their conversation, they showed no sign of it. The only remark I remember Mistress Hasty making to me specifically was that I should take greater care in washing my neck. Then Mistress Hasty shooed me from the room as if I were an annoying chicken, and I found myself finally heading to the kitchens for some food. That afternoon I was back with Hod, practicing until I was sure my stave had mysteriously doubled its weight. Then food, and bed, and up again in the morning and back to Burridge's tutelage. My learning filled my days, and any spare time I found was swallowed up with the chores associated with my learning, whether it was tack care for Burridge, or sweeping the armory and putting it back in order for Hod. In due time I found not one or even two, but three entire sets of clothing, including stockings, set out one afternoon on my bed. Two were of fairly ordinary stuff, in a familiar brown that most of the children my age seemed to wear. But one was of thin blue cloth, and on the breast was a buck's head done in silver thread. Burridge and the other men-at-arms wore a leaping buck as their emblem. I had only seen the buck's head on the jerkins of Regal and Verity. So I looked at it and wondered, but wondered, too, at the slash of red stitching that cut it diagonally, marching right over the design. "It means you're a bastard," Burridge told me bluntly when I asked him about it. "Of acknowledged royal blood, but a bastard all the same, that's all. It's just a quick way of showing you've royal blood, but aren't of the true line. If you don't like it, you can change it. I am sure the king would grant it. A name and a crest of your own."
"A name?"
"Certainly. It's a simple enough request. Bastards are rare in the noble houses, especially so in the king's own. but they aren't unheard of. Under guise of teaching me the proper care of a saddle, we were going through the tack room, looking over all the old and unused tack. Maintaining and salvaging old tack was one of Burrich's odder fixations. Devise a name and crest for yourself, and then ask the king,
"What name?"
"Why, any name you like. Well, this looks like it's ruined. Someone put it away damp and it mildewed. But we'll see what we can do with it."
"It wouldn't feel real."
"What?" He held an armload of smelly leather out toward me. I took it.
"A name I just put to myself. It wouldn't feel like it was really mine."
"Well, what do you intend to do then?"
I took a breath. "The king should name me. Or you should." I steeled myself. "Or my father, don't you think?"
Burrich frowned. "You get the most peculiar notions. Just think about it yourself for a while. You'll come up with a name that fits."
"Fits,"
I said sarcastically, and I saw Burrich clamp his jaw. "Let's just mend this leather," he suggested quietly. We carried it to his workbench and started wiping it down.
"Bastards aren't that rare," I observed.
"And in town their parents name them." "In town, bastards aren't so rare." Burrich agreed after a moment. "Soldiers and sailors whore around. It's a common way for common folk, but not for royalty. Or for anyone with a bit of pride. What would you have thought of me when you were younger if I'd gone out whoring at night or brought women up to the room? How would you see women now, or men? It's fine to fall in love, Fitz, and no one begrudges a young woman or man a kiss or two, but I've seen what it's like down to Bingtown. Traders bring pretty girls or well-made youths to the market like so many chickens or so many potatoes, and the children they end up bearing may have names, but they don't have much else. And even when they marry, they don't stop their habits. If ever I find the right woman, I'll want her to know I won't be looking at another. And I'll want to know all my children are mine." Burrich was almost impassioned. I looked at him miserably.
"So, what happened with my father?"
He suddenly looked weary. "I don't know, boy. I don't know. He was young, just 20 or so, and far from home, and trying to shoulder a heavy burden. Those are neither reasons nor excuses. But it's as much as either of us will ever know." And that was that. My life went round in its settled routine. There were evenings that I spent in the stables, in Burrich's company, and more rarely, evenings that I spent in the great hall when some travelling minstrel or puppet show arrived. Once in a great while I could slip out for an evening down in town, but that meant paying the next day for missed sleep. Afternoons were inevitably spent with some tutor or instructor. I came to understand that these were my summer lessons, and that in winter I would be introduced to the kind of learning that came with pens and letters. I was kept busier than I had ever been in my young life, but despite my schedule, I found myself mostly alone. Loneliness. It found me every night as I vainly tried to find a small and cozy spot in my big bed. When I had slept above the stables in Burrich's rooms, my nights had been muzzy, my dreams heathery, and the warm and weary contentment of the well-used animals that slept and shifted and thudded in the night below me. Horses and dogs dream, as anyone who has ever watched a hound yipping and twitching in dream pursuit well knows. Their dreams had been like the sweet rising waft from a baking of good bread. But now, isolated in a room walled with stone, I finally had time for all those devouring, aching dreams that are the portion of humans. I had no warm dam to cozy against, no sense of siblings or kin stabled nearby. Instead, I would lie awake and wonder about my father and mother, and how both could have dismissed me from their lives so easily. I heard the talk that others exchanged so carelessly over my head,
and interpreted their comments in my own terrifying way. I wondered what would become of me when I was grown and old King Shrewd dead and gone. I wondered occasionally if Molly Nosebleed and Carrie missed me, or if they accepted my sudden disappearance as easily as they had accepted my coming. But mostly, I ached with loneliness, for in all that great keep there were none I sensed as friend, none save the beasts, and Burridge had forbidden me to have any closeness with them. One evening, I had gone wearily to bed, only to torment myself with my fears until sleep grudgingly pulled me under. Light in my face awoke me, but I came awake knowing something was wrong. I hadn't slept long enough, and this light was yellow and wavering, unlike the whiteness of the sunlight that usually spilled in my window. I stirred unwillingly and opened my eyes. He stood at the foot of my bed, holding aloft a lamp. This in itself was a rarity at Buckkeep, but more than the buttery light from the lamp held my eyes. The man himself was strange. His robe was the color of undyed sheep's wool that had been washed, but only intermittently and not recently. His hair and beard were about the same color, and their untidiness gave the same impression. Despite the color of his hair, I could not decide how old he was. There are some poxes that will scar a man's face with their passage, but I had never seen a man marked as he was, with scores of tiny pox scars, angry pinks and red like small burns, and livid even in the lamp's yellow light. His hands were all bones and tendons wrapped in papery white skin. He was peering at me, and even in the lamplight his eyes were the most piercing green I had ever seen. They reminded me of a cat's eyes when it is hunting something, the same combination of joy and fierceness. I pulled my quilt up higher under my chin.
"You're awake," he said.
"Good.
Get up and follow me."
He turned abruptly from my bedside and walked away from the door to a shadowed corner of my room between the hearth and the wall. I didn't move. He glanced back at me, held the lamp higher.
"Hurry up, boy,"
he said irritably, and rapped the stick he leaned on against my bedpost. I got out of bed, wincing as my bare feet hit the cold floor. I reached for my clothes and shoes, but he wasn't waiting for me. He glanced back once to see what was delaying me, and the piercing look was enough to make me drop my clothes and quake. And I followed, wordlessly, in my nightshirt, for no reason I could explain to myself, except that he had suggested it. I followed him to a door that had never been there, and up a narrow flight of winding steps that were lit only by the lamp he held above his head. His shadow fell behind him and over me, so that I walked in a shifting darkness, feeling each step with my feet. The stairs were cold stone, worn and smooth, and remarkably even. And they went up, and up, and up, until it seemed to me that we had climbed past the height of any tower the keep possessed. A chill breeze flowed up those steps, and up my nightshirt, shriveling me with more than mere cold. And we went up. And then finally he was pushing open a substantial door that nonetheless moved silently and easily. We entered a chamber. It was lit warmly by several lamps, suspended from an unseen ceiling on fine chains. The chamber was large, easily three times the size of my own. One end of it beckoned me. It was dominated by a massive wooden bed frame, fat with feather beds and cushions. There were carpets on the floor, overlapping one another with their scarlets and verdant greens and blues, both deep and pale. There was a table made of wood, the color of wild honey, and on it sat a bowl of fruit so perfectly ripe that I could smell their fragrances. Parchment books and scrolls were scattered about carelessly, as if their rarity were of no concern.
All three walls were draped with tapestries that depicted open rolling country with wooded foothills in the distance. I started toward it.
"This way,"
my guide said, and relentlessly led me to the other end of the chamber. Here was a different spectacle. A stone slab of a table dominated it, its surface much stained and scorched. Upon it were various tools, containers and implements, a scale, a mortar and pestle, and many things I couldn't name. A fine layer of dust overlaid much of it, as if projects had been abandoned in mid-course, months or even years ago. Beyond the table was a rack that held an untidy collection of scrolls, some edged in blue or gilt. The scent of the room was at once pungent and aromatic. Bundles of herbs were drying on another rack. I heard a rustling and caught a glimpse of movement in a far corner, but the man gave me no time to investigate. The fireplace that should have warmed this end of the room gaped black and cold. The old embers in it looked damp and settled. I lifted my eyes from my perusal to look at my guide. The dismay on my face seemed to surprise him. He turned from me and slowly surveyed the room himself. He considered it a bit, and then I sensed an embarrassed disgruntlement from him.
"It's a mess. More than a mess, I suppose. But, well, it's been a while, I suppose, and longer than a while. Well, it's soon put to rights. But first, introductions are in order. And I suppose it is a bit nippy to be standing about in just a nightshirt. This way, boy."
I followed him to the comfortable end of the room. He seated himself in a battered wooden chair that was overdraped with blankets. My bare toes dug gratefully into the nap of a woolen rug. I stood before him, waiting, as those green eyes prowled over me. For some minutes, the silence held. Then he spoke.
"First, let me introduce you to yourself. Your pedigree is written all over you."
Shrewd chose to acknowledge it, for all his denials wouldn't have sufficed to convince anyone otherwise. He paused for an instant and smiled, as if something amused him. "The shame Galen refuses to teach you the skill. But years ago it was restricted for fear it would become too common a tool. I'll wager if old Galen were to try to teach you, he'd find you apt. But we have no time to worry about what won't happen." He sighed, meditatively, and was silent for a moment. Abruptly he went on.
"Berridge's shown you both how to work and how to obey. Two things that Berridge himself exceeds at. You're not especially strong or fast or bright. Don't think you are. But you'll have the stubbornness to wear down anyone stronger or faster or brighter than yourself, and that's more of a danger to you than to anyone else. But that is not what is now most important about you. You are the king's man now, and you must begin to understand now, right now, that that is the most important thing about you. He feeds you, he clothes you, he sees you are educated, and all he asks in return for now is your loyalty. Later, he will ask your service. Those are the conditions under which I will teach you that you are the king's man and loyal to him completely. For if you are otherwise, it would be too dangerous to educate you in my art."
He paused, and for a long moment we simply looked at one another.
"Do you agree?"
he asked. And it was not a simple question, but the sealing of a bargain. "I do," I said, and then, as he waited, "I give you my word."
"Good."
He spoke the word heartily.
"Now, on to other things. Have you ever seen me before?"
"No." I realized for an instant how strange that was. For though there were often strangers in the keep, this man had obviously been a resident for a long, long time, and almost all those who lived there I knew by sight, if not name.
"Do you know who I am, boy?"
or why you're here?" I shook my head, a quick negative to each question.
"Well, no one else does either. So you mind it stays that way. Make yourself clear on that. You speak to no one of what we do here, nor of anything you learn. Understand that?"
My nod must have satisfied him, for he seemed to relax in the chair. His bony hands gripped the knobs of his knees through his woolen robe.
"Good. Good. Now, you can call me Chade, and I shall call you."
He paused and waited, but when I did not offer a name, he filled in,
"Boy." "That's not names for either of us, but they'll do for the time we'll have together. So, I'm Chade, and I'm yet another teacher that Shrewd has found for you. It took him a while to remember I was here, and then it took him a space to nerve himself to ask me. And it took me even longer to agree to teach you. But all that's done now. As to what I'm to teach you, well..."
He rose and moved to the fire. He cocked his hand as he stared into it, then stooped to take a poker and stir the embers to fresh flames.
"It's murder, more or less. Killing people. The fine art of diplomatic assassination. Or blinding, or deafening. Or a weakening of the limbs. Or a paralysis. Or a debilitating cough. Or impotency. Or early senility, or insanity, or... But it doesn't matter. It's all been my trade, and it will be yours, if you agree. Just know, from the beginning, that I'm not going to be teaching you how to kill people. For your king. Not in the showy way Hard is teaching you. Not on the battlefield where others see and cheer you on. No. I'll be teaching you the nasty, furtive, polite ways to kill people. You'll either develop a taste for it or not. That isn't something I'm in charge of. But I'll make sure you know how, and I'll make sure of one other thing, for that was the stipulation I made with King Shrewd. That you know what you are learning, as I never did when I was your age. So, I'm to teach you to be an assassin. Is that all right with you, boy?"
I nodded again, uncertain, but not knowing what else to do. He peered at me.
"You can speak, can you? You're not a mute as well as a bastard, are you?"
I swallowed. "No, sir. I can speak."
"Well then, do speak. Don't just nod. Tell me what you think of all this, of who I am and what I just proposed that we do."
Invited to speak, I yet stood dumb. I stared at the poxed face, the papery skin of his hands, and felt the gleam of his green eyes on me. I moved my tongue inside my mouth, but found only silence. His manner invited words, but his visage was still more terrifying than anything I had ever imagined.
"Boy," he said,
and the gentleness in his voice startled me into meeting his eyes.
"I can teach you, even if you hate me, or if you despise the lessons. I can teach you if you are bored, or lazy, or stupid. But I can't teach you if you're afraid to speak to me. At least, not the way I want to teach you. And I can't teach you if you decide this is something you'd rather not learn, but you have to tell me. You've learned to guard your thoughts so well, you're almost afraid to let yourself know what they are. But try speaking them aloud, now, to me. You won't be punished."
"I don't much like it," I suddenly blurted. "The idea of killing people."
"Ah." He paused. "Neither did I, when it came down to it. Nor do I still..."
He sighed suddenly, deeply.
"As each time comes, you'll decide. The first time will be the hardest, but know, for now, that decision is many years away. and in the meantime you have much to learn."
He hesitated.
"There is this, boy, and you should remember it in every situation, not just this one. Learning is never wrong. Even learning how to kill isn't wrong. All right. It's just a thing to learn. A thing I can teach you, that's all. For now. Do you think you could learn how to do it, and later decide if you want to do it?"
Such a question to put to a boy. Even then, something in me raised its hackles and sniffed at the idea, but boy that I was, I could find no objection to raise. And curiosity was nibbling at me.
"I can learn it."
"Good."
He smiled. But there was a tiredness to his face, and he didn't seem as pleased as he might have.
"That's well enough, then. Well enough."
He looked around the room.
"We may as well begin tonight. Let's start by tidying up. There's a broom over there. Oh, but first, change out of your nightshirt into something. Ah, there's a ragged old robe over there. That'll do for now. Can't have the washer folk wondering why your nightshirts smell of camphor and pain's ease, can we? Now, you sweep up the floor a bit while I put away a few things."
And so passed the next few hours. I swept, then mopped the stone floor. He directed me as I cleared the paraphernalia from the great table. I turned the herbs on their drying rack. I fed the three lizards he had caged in the corner, chopping up some sticky old meat into chunks that they gulped whole. I wiped clean a number of pots and bowls and stored them. And he worked alongside me, seeming grateful for the company, and chatted to me as if we were both old men, or young boys.
"No letters as yet? No ciphering? Bagrash! What's the old man thinking? Well, I shall see that remedied swiftly. You've your father's brow, boy, and just his way of wrinkling it. Has anyone ever told you that before? Ah, there you are, Slink, you rascal! What mischief have you been up to now?"
A brown weasel appeared from behind a tapestry, and we were introduced to one another. Chade let me feed Slink quail eggs from a bowl on the table, and laughed when the little beast followed me about begging for more. He gave me a copper bracelet that I found under the table, warning that it might make my wrist green, and cautioning that if anyone asked me about it, I should say I had found it behind the stables. At some time we stopped for honey cakes and hot spiced wine. We sat together at a low table on some rugs before the fireplace, and I watched the firelight dancing over his scarred face, and wondered why it had seemed so frightening. He noticed me watching him, and his face contorted in a smile.
"Seems familiar, doesn't it, boy? My face, I mean."
It didn't. I had been staring at the grotesque scars on the pasty white skin. I had no idea what he meant. I stared at him questioningly, trying to figure it out.
"Don't trouble yourself about it, boy. It leaves its tracks on all of us, and sooner or later you'll get the tumble of it. But now, well..."
He rose, stretching so that his cassock bared his skinny white calves.
"Now it's mostly later. Or earlier, depending on which end of the day you fancy most. Time you headed back to your bed. Now, you'll remember that this is all a very dark secret, won't you? Not just me in this room, but the whole thing. Waking up at night, and lessons in how to kill people, and all of it."
"I'll remember,"
I told him. And then, sensing it would mean something to him, I added,
"You have my word."
He chuckled, and then nodded almost sadly. I changed back into my nightrobe, and he saw me down the steps. He held his glowing light by my bed as I clambered in, and then smoothed the blankets over me, as no one had done since I'd left Burridge's chambers. I think I was asleep before he had even departed from my bedside. Brant was sent to waken me the next morning, so late was I in arising. I came awake groggy, my head pounding painfully, but as soon as he left, I sprang from my bed and raced to the corner of my room. Cold stone met my hands as I pushed against the wall there, and no crack in mortar or stone gave any sign of the secret door I felt sure must be there. Never for one instant did I think Chade had been a dream, and even if I had, there remained the simple copper bracelet on my wrist to prove he wasn't. I dressed hurriedly and passed through the kitchens for a slab of bread and cheese that I was still eating when I got to the stables. Burridge was out of sorts with my tardiness, and found fault with every aspect of my horsemanship and stable tasks. I remember well how he berated me. "Don't think that because you've a room up in the castle and a crest on your jerkin, you can turn into some sprawl-about rogue who snores in his bed until all hours, and then only rises to fluff at his hair." "I'll not have it. Bastard you may be, but your chivalry's bastard, and I'll make you a man he'll be proud of." I paused, the grooming brushes still in my hands. "You mean Regal, don't you?" My unwanted question startled him.
"What?"
"When you talk about rogues who stay in bed all morning and do nothing except fuss about their hair and garments, you mean how Regal is." Burridge opened his mouth and then shut it. His wind-reddened cheeks grew redder.
"Neither you nor I,"
he muttered at last,
"are in a position to criticize any of the princes. I meant only as a general rule that sleeping the morning away ill befits a man, and even less so a boy."
"And never a prince." I said this, and then stopped, to wonder where the thought had come from.
"And never a prince."
Burridge agreed grimly. He was busy in the next stall with a gelding's hot leg. The animal winced suddenly, and I heard Burridge grunt with the effort of holding him. "Your father never slept past the sun's midpoint because he'd been drinking the night before. Of course, he had a head for wine like I've never seen since, but there was discipline to it, too. Nor did he have some man standing by to rouse him. He got himself out of bed, and then expected those in his command to follow his example. It didn't always make him popular, but his soldiers respected him, men like that in a leader, that he demands of himself the same thing he expects of them. And I'll tell you another thing. Your father didn't waste coin on decking himself out like a peacock. When he was a younger man, before he was wed to Lady Patience, he was at dinner one evening at one of the lesser keeps. They'd seated me not too far below him, a great honour to me, and I overheard some of his conversation with the daughter they'd seated so hopefully next to the king-in-waiting. She'd asked him what he thought of the emeralds she wore, and he had complimented her on them. 'I had wondered, sir, if you enjoyed jewels, for you wear none of them yourself tonight,' she said flirtatiously. And he replied quite seriously that his jewels shone as brightly as hers, and much larger. 'Oh, and where do you keep such gems, for I should dearly love to see them?' 'Well,' he replied, 'he'd be happy to show them to her later that evening, when it was darker.' I saw her blush, expecting a tryst of some kind. And later he did invite her out onto the battlements with him, but he took with them half the dinner guests as well. And he pointed out the lights of the coast watchtowers, shining clearly in the dark, and told her that he considered those his best and dearest jewels, and that he spent the coin from her father's taxes to keep them shining so. And then he pointed out to the guests the winking lights of that lord's own watchman in the fortifications of his keep, and told them that when they looked at their duke, they should see those shining lights as the jewels on his brow. It was quite a compliment to the Duke and Duchess, and the other nobles there took note of it. The Out-Islanders had very few successful raids that summer. That is how chivalry ruled, by example, and by the grace of his words. So should any real prince do."
"I'm not a real prince. I'm a bastard."
It came oddly from my mouth, that word I heard so often, and so seldom said.
Burich sighed softly.
Be of your blood, boy, and ignore what anyone else thinks of you.
Sometimes I get tired of doing the hard things.
So do I.
I absorbed this in silence for a while, as I worked my way down Sooty's shoulder. Burich, still crouched by the gelding, spoke suddenly.
I don't ask any more of you than I ask of myself. You know that's true.
I know that, I replied, surprised that he'd mentioned it further.
I just want to do my best by you.
This was a whole new idea to me. After a moment, I asked, because if you could make chivalry proud of me, of what you'd made me into, then maybe he would come back.
The rhythmic sound of Burich's hands working liniment into the gelding's leg slowed,
then ceased abruptly. But he remained crouched down by the horse and spoke quietly through the wall of the stall.
No. I don't think that. I don't suppose anything would make him come back.
And even if he did, and Burich spoke more slowly,
even if he did, he wouldn't be who he was. Before, I mean.
It's all my fault he went away, isn't it?
The words of the weaving women echoed in my head, but for the boy, he'd still be in line to be king.
Burich paused long.
I don't suppose it's any man's fault that he's born.
He sighed, and the words seemed to come more reluctantly.
And there's certainly no way a babe can make itself not a bastard.
No.
Chivalry brought his downfall on himself, though that's a hard thing for me to say.
I heard his hands go back to work on the gelding's leg. And your downfall, too. I said it to Sooty's shoulder, softly, never dreaming he'd hear. But a moment or two later I heard him mutter,
I do well enough for myself, Fitz.
I do well enough.
He finished his task and came around into Sooty's stall.
Your tongue's wagging like the town gossip today, Fitz. What's got into you?
It was my turn to pause and wonder. Something about Chade, I decided. Something about someone who wanted me to understand and have a say in what I was learning had freed up my tongue to finally ask all the questions I'd been carrying about for years. But because I couldn't very well say so, I shrugged and truthfully replied,
"They're just things I've wondered about for a long time."
Burich grunted his acceptance of the answer.
"Well, it's an improvement that you ask, though I won't always promise you an answer. It's good to hear you speak like a man. Makes me worry less about losing you to the beasts."
He glared at me over the last words, and then gimped away. I watched him go and remembered that first night I had seen him, and how a look from him had been enough to quell a whole room full of men. He wasn't the same man. And it wasn't just the limp that had changed the way he carried himself and how men looked at him. He was still the acknowledged master of the stables, and no one questioned his authority there. But he was no longer the right hand of the king-in-waiting. Other than watching over me, he wasn't chivalry's man at all anymore. No wonder he couldn't look at me without resentment. He hadn't sired the bastard that had been his downfall. For the first time since I'd known him, my wariness of him was tinged with pity.
5. Loyalties. In some kingdoms and lands, it is the custom that male children will have the precedent over female in matters of inheritance. Such has never been the case in the 6 duchies. Titles are inherited solely by order of birth. The one who inherits a title is supposed to view it as a stewardship. If a lord or lady were so foolish as to cut too much forest at once, or neglect vineyards, or let the quality of the cattle become too inbred, the people of the duchy could rise up and come to ask for king's justice. It has happened, and every noble is aware it can happen. The welfare of the people belongs to the people, and they have the right to object if their duke stewards it poorly. When the title holder weds, he is supposed to keep this in mind. The partner chosen must be willing likewise to be a steward. For this reason, the partner holding a lesser title must surrender it to the next younger sibling. One can only be a true steward of one holding. On occasion, this has led to divisions. King Shrewd married Lady Desire, who would have been Duchess of Pharaoh had she not chosen to accept his offer and become queen instead. It is said that she came to regret her decision, and convinced herself that had she remained Duchess, her power would have been greater. She married Shrewd, knowing well she was his second queen, and that the first had already borne him 2 heirs. She never concealed her disdain for the 2 older princes, and often pointed out that she was much higher born than King Shrewd's first queen. She considered her son, Regal, to be more royal than his 2 half-brothers. She attempted to instill this idea in others by her choice of name for her son. Unfortunately for her plans, most saw this ploy as poor taste. Some even mockingly referred to her as the Inland Queen, for when intoxicated, she would ruthlessly claim that she had the political influence to unite Pharaoh and Tilth into a new kingdom, one that would shrug off King Shrewd's rule at her behest. But most put her claims down to her fondness for intoxicants, both alcoholic and herbal. It is true, however, that before she finally succumbed to her addictions, she was responsible for nurturing the rift between the inland and coastal duchies. I grew to look forward to my dark-time encounters with Chade. They never had a schedule, nor any pattern that I could discern. A week, even 2, might go by between meetings, or he might summon me every night for a week straight, leaving me staggering about my daytime chores. Sometimes he summoned me as soon as the castle was abed. At other times, he called upon me in the wee hours of the morning. It was a strenuous schedule for a growing boy, yet I never thought of complaining to Chade, or refusing one of his calls. Nor do I think it ever occurred to him that my night lessons presented a difficulty for me. Nocturnal himself, it must have seemed a perfectly natural time for him to be teaching me, and the lessons I learned were oddly suited to the darker hours of the world. There was tremendous scope to his lessons. One evening might be spent in my laborious study of the illustrations in a great herbal he kept, with the requirement that the next day I was to collect 6 samples that matched those illustrations. He never saw fit to hint as to whether I should look in the kitchen garden or the darker nooks of the forest for those herbs, but find them I did, and learned much of observation in the process. There were games we played, too. For instance, he would tell me that I must go on the morrow to Sarah the cook and ask her if this year's bacon was leaner than last year's, and then I must that evening report the entire conversation back to Chade, as close to word-perfect as I could, and answer a 12 questions for him about how she stood, and was she left-handed, and did she seem hard of hearing, and what she was cooking at the time. My shyness and reticence were never accounted a good enough excuse for failing to execute such an assignment, and so I found myself meeting and coming to know a good many of the lesser folk of the keep. Even though my questions were inspired by Chade, every one of them welcomed my interest and was more than willing to share expertise. Without intending it, I began to garner a reputation as a sharp youngster and a good lad. Years later, I realized that the lesson was not just a memory exercise, but also instruction in how to befriend the commoner folk and to learn their minds. Many's the time since then that a smile, a compliment on how well my horse had been cared for, and a quick question put to a stable boy, brought me information that all the coin in the kingdom couldn't have bribed out of him. Other games built my nerve, as well as my powers of observation. One day, Chade showed me a skein of yarn and told me that, without asking Mistress Hasty, I must find out exactly where she kept the supply of yarn that matched it, and what herbs had been used in the dyeing of it. 3 days later, I was told I must spirit away her best shears, conceal them behind a certain rack of wines in the wine cellar for 3 hours, and then return them to where they had been, all undetected by her or anyone else. Such exercises initially appealed to a boy's natural love of mischief, and I seldom failed at them. When I did, the consequences were my own lookout. Chade had warned me that he would not shield me from anybody's wrath, and suggested that I have a worthy tale ready to explain away being where I should not be, or possessing that which I had no business possessing. I learned to lie very well. I do not think it was taught me accidentally. These were the lessons in my assassin's primer. And more. Sleight of hand and the art of moving stealthily. Where to strike a man to render him unconscious. Where to strike a man so that he dies without crying out. Where to stab a man so that he dies without too much blood welling out. I learned it all rapidly and well, thriving under Chade's approval of my quick mind. Soon he began to use me for small jobs about the keep. He never told me, ahead of time, if they were tests of my skill, or actual tasks he wished accomplished. To me it made no difference. I pursued them all with a single-minded devotion to Chade and anything he commanded. In spring of that year, I treated the wine cups of a visiting delegation from the Bingtown traders so that they became much more intoxicated than they had intended. Later that same month, I concealed one puppet from a visiting puppeteer's troupe so that he had to present the incidents of the matching cups, a light-hearted little folktale, instead of the lengthy historical drama he had planned for the evening. At the high summer feast, I added a certain herb to a serving girl's afternoon pot of tea, so that she and 3 of her friends were stricken with loose bowels, and could not wait the tables that night. In fall, I tied a thread around the fetlock of a visiting noble's horse, to give the animal a temporary limp that convinced the noble to remain at Buck Keep 2 days longer than he had planned. I never knew the underlying reasons for the tasks Chade set me. At that age, I set my mind to how I would do a thing, rather than why. And that, too, was a thing that I believe it was intended I learn, to obey without asking why an order was given. There was one task that absolutely delighted me. Even at the time, I knew that the assignment was more than a whim of Chade's. He summoned me for it in the last bit of dark before dawn.
Lord Jessop and his lady have been visiting this last 2 weeks. You know them by sight. He has a very long moustache, and she constantly fusses with her hair, even at the table. You know who I mean?
I frowned. A number of nobles had gathered at Buck Keep to form a council to discuss the increase in raids from the out-islanders. I gathered that the coastal duchies wanted more warships, but the inland duchies opposed sharing the taxes for what they saw as a purely coastal problem. Lord Jessop and Lady Dahlia were inlanders. Jessop and his moustaches both seemed to have fitful temperaments and to be constantly impassioned. Lady Dahlia, on the other hand, seemed to take no interest at all in the council, but spent most of her time exploring Buck Keep.
She wears flowers in her hair all the time. They keep falling out.
"That's the one," Chade replied emphatically. "Good, you know her. Now, here's your task, and I've no time to plan it with you. Sometime today, at any moment today, she will send a page to Prince Regal's room. The page will deliver something—a note, a flower, an object of some kind. You will remove the object from Regal's room before he sees it. You understand?
I nodded, and opened my mouth to say something, but Chade stood abruptly, and almost chased me from the room.
No time! It is nearly dawn!
He declared. I contrived to be in Regal's room, in hiding, when the page arrived. From the way the girl slipped in, I was convinced this was not her first mission. She set a tiny scroll and a flower bud on Regal's pillow and slipped out of the room. In a moment, both were in my jerkin and later under my own pillow. I think the most difficult part of the task was refraining from opening the scroll. I turned scroll and flower over to Chade late that night. Over the next few days I waited, certain there would be some sort of furor and hoping to see Regal thoroughly discomfited. But to my surprise, there was none. Regal remained his usual self, save that he was even sharper than usual, and seemed to flirt even more outrageously with every lady. As for Lady Dahlia, she suddenly took an interest in the council proceedings and confounded her husband by becoming an ardent supporter of warship taxes. The Queen expressed her displeasure over this change of alliance by excluding Lady Dahlia from a wine-tasting in her chambers. The whole thing mystified me, but when I at last mentioned it to Chade, he rebuked me.
Remember, you are the King's man. A task is given you and you do it, and you should be well satisfied with yourself that you completed the given task. That is all you need to know. Only shrewd may plan the moves and plot his game. You and I, we are playing pieces, perhaps, but we are the best of his markers, be assured of that.
But early on, Chade found the limits of my obedience. In laming the horse, he had suggested I cut the frog of the animal's foot. I never even considered doing that. I informed him with all the worldly wisdom of one who has grown up around horses that there were many ways to make a horse limp without actually harming him, and that he should trust me to choose an appropriate one. To this day, I do not know how Chade felt about my refusal. He said nothing at the time to condemn it or to suggest he approved my actions. In this, as in many things, he kept his own counsel. Once every 3 months or so, King Shrewd would summon me to his chambers. Usually the call for me came in the very early morning. I would stand before him, oftentimes while he was in his bath, or having his hair bound back in the gold-wired queue that only the king could wear, or while his man was laying out his clothes. Always the ritual was the same. He would look me over carefully, studying my growth and grooming as if I were a horse he was considering buying. He would ask a question or two about my horsemanship or weapons study, usually, and listen gravely to my brief answer. And then he would ask, almost formally,
"And do you feel I am keeping my bargain with you?"
"Sir, I do," I would always answer.
"Then, see that you keep your end of it as well,"
was always his reply and my dismissal. And whatever servant attending him or opening the door for me to enter or leave never appeared to take the slightest notice of me or of the king's words at all. Come late fall of that year, on the very cusp of winter's tooth, I was given my most difficult assignment. Chade had summoned me up to his chambers almost as soon as I had blown out my night candle. We were sharing sweet meats and a bit of spiced wine, sitting in front of Chade's hearth. He had been lavishly praising my latest escapade, one that required me turning inside out every shirt hung to dry on the laundry courtyard's drying lines, without getting caught. It had been a difficult task, the hardest part of which had been to refrain from laughing aloud and betraying my hiding place within a dyeing vat, when two of the younger laundry lads had declared my prank the work of water sprites and refused to do any more washing that day. Chade, as usual, knew of the whole scenario even before I reported it to him. He delighted me by letting me know that Master Liu of the Launderers
had decreed that St. John's wort was to be hung at every corner of the courtyard and garlanded about every well to ward off sprites for tomorrow's work.
"You've a gift for this boy,"
Chade chuckled and tousled my hair.
"I almost think there's no task I could set you that you couldn't do."
He was sitting in his straight-backed chair before the fire, and I was on the floor beside him, leaning my back against one of his legs. He patted me the way Burridge might pat a young bird dog that had done well, and then leaned forward to say softly,
"But I've a challenge for you."
"What is it?" I demanded eagerly.
"It won't be easy, even for one with as light a touch as yours,"
he warned me. "Try me." I challenged him in return.
"Oh, in another month or two, perhaps, when you've had a bit more teaching. I've a game to teach you tonight, one that will sharpen your eye and your memory."
He reached into a pouch and drew out a handful of something. He opened his hand briefly in front of me, colored stones. The hand closed.
"Were there any yellow ones?"
"Yes, Chade, what is the challenge?"
"How many?"
"Two that I could see. Chade, I bet I could do it now."
"Could there have been more than two?"
"Possibly. If some were concealed completely under the top layer, I don't think it likely. Chade, what is the challenge?" He opened his bony old hand, stirred the stones with his long forefinger.
"Right you were. Only two yellow ones. Shall we go again?"
"Chade, I can do it."
"You think so, do you? Look again, here's the stones. One, two, three, and gone again. Were there any red ones?"
"Yes, Chade, what is the task?"
"Were there more red ones than blue?" "To bring me something personal from the king's night table."
"What?"
"Were there more red stones than blue ones?"
"No, I mean, what was the task?"
"Wrong, boy!"
Chade announced it merrily. He opened his fist.
"See? Three red and three blue. Exactly the same. You'll have to look quicker than that if you're to meet my challenge."
"And seven green, I knew that, Chade. But you want me to steal from the king?" I still couldn't believe I had heard it.
"Not steal, just borrow. As you did Mistress Hasty's shears. There's no harm in a prank like that, is there?"
"None, except that I'd be whipped if I were caught, or worse."
"And you're afraid you'd be caught. See? I told you it had best wait a month or two until your skills were better."
"It's not the punishment. It's that if I were caught, the king and I, we made a bargain." My words dwindled away. I stared at him in confusion. Chade's instruction was a part of the bargain Shrewd and I had made. Each time we met, before he began instructing me, he formally reminded me of that bargain. I had given to Chade as well as the king my word that I would be loyal. Surely he could see that if I acted against the king, I'd be breaking my part of the bargain.
"It's a game, boy,"
Chade said patiently.
"That's all. Just a bit of mischief. It's not really so serious as you seem to think. The only reason I'm choosing it as a task is that the king's room and his things are so closely watched. Anyone can make off with a seamstress's shears. We're talking about a real bit of stealth now. To enter the king's own chambers and take something that belongs to him. If you could do that, I'd believe I'd spent my time well in teaching you."